Our Coast Planning and Land Development Regulation Board, would you please rise for the pledge? Thank you. I apologize for the late start. We were getting into the 21st century in terms of computer work. Are you going to call the roll?
Mr. Smith?
Here.
Mrs. Lucas?
Here.
Mr. Dahlman? Mr. Jones?
Here.
Mr. Scully?
Here.
Mr. Davis?
Here.
Mr. Lenhartz?
Here.
Mr. Freeman?
Here.
Mr. Chair, we have quorum.
Excellent. First order of business this evening is the approval of the minutes of our meeting from January the 17th. Does anybody have any additions or deletions from the minutes?
Move their approval.
I have a motion to approve.
A second.
And a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you. Next order of business is an ordinance to adopt the First Amendment of the Grand Landings Master Plan Development. Mr. Tyner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, this is Grand Landings, which is south of the Flagler County Airport. It's really a hot area right now where there's a lot of single-family units being developed, and it's pretty much only about 40% built out. A lot more development is happening as we speak. This is, historically, this was approved by the county as a PUD. They had a development agreement and then was annexed into the city. There was an amendment in 2014 where we took the, basically the county language into the city language and rezoned to master plan development consistent with our zoning and our comprehensive plan. This is our first amendment to that master plan development agreement. It's a minor amendment. There's a few things that the applicant and the city staff agree with, and Ida, me and our senior planner will have those details.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and Commissioners. This is application 3481, proposed first modification to the Grand Landings Master Plan Development. As Ray said, the zoning was approved by the...
Would you take the push the microphone a little closer?
Sure.
Some of our older ears, including mine, are...
Okay. The zoning was originally approved by Flagler County in 2005 as a planned unit development. Project was annexed into the city in 2007. The city amended the planned unit development to master plan development in 2014, and that meant that we were able to apply our city standards, our 2008 land development code. So the City of Palm Coast Ordinance 2014-11 is the controlling document. In terms of location, the project, the development, of course, is south of the airport, south of State Road 100, east of Belter Boulevard, and west of Seminole Woods Parkway. The zoning is master plan development. The future land use is largely residential. There's a small commercial component towards Seminole Woods Boulevard. Currently, phases 3B and 3C are under construction. And I will also like to point out that the master plan development allows both single family attached dwelling units and single family detached dwelling units. In terms of where Grand Landings is today, the master plan development allows up to 749 units. The work on phases 1, 2, and 3 is either complete or largely underway. In terms of platted lots, the development is at 289 units or platted lots. It's roughly about 40% of the overall development scheme in terms of the residential aspect of this. The applicant has requested changes to two sections of the Master Plan Development Agreement. One section is referred to as 6B1. It's the wetland buffer language. The second section is referred to as 7A under the Site Development Program. With regard to the wetland buffer, the proposal is to allow averaging consistent with Chapter 10.01.08A of the City's Unified Land Development Code. Also, staff suggested, and the applicant has agreed, to allow wildfire mitigation as allowable use in the wetland buffer. This is just a recommended fire-wise practice. This is the specific proposed language. Instead of a minimum of 25 feet for the wetland buffer with no flexibility, it allows an averaging of 25 feet but not less than 15 feet of natural wetland upper buffer. Again, this is consistent with the city's Land Development Code, Chapter 10. It also has another set of changes which relates to the St. John's Water Management District interpretation of wetland buffers. And lastly, it adds the wildfire mitigation component to the language. The neighborhood information meeting was held February 12th. One of the issues reported was concerned about increasing of entitlements. This proposal does not increase the number of units, nor does it change the setbacks or the overall development program for Grand Landing's master plan. The other set of changes referred to the site development regulations. This reduces the allowable lot minimum for single-family detached homes from 50 feet to 45 feet. Again, the setbacks would remain the same. And the fourth minor amendment is to reduce the allowable lot size from single-family detached units from 6,250 square feet to 5,000 square feet. This is how the proposed change would look on the site development table. Again, as you see, there's already an option for single-family attached dwelling units. This would refer to future development for single-family detached units. This is a prototype of the homes that could be built with the modification. You see that they're very attractive, and it would just allow different product mix and development type to be permitted within the Grand Landings development. Again, this is another prototype. This is a two-story home, a little smaller footprint, but again, very compatible with the existing development there. So in summary, I just want to say from a staff perspective, this is a development that was approved in 2005. It's a multi-year development. It's now 13 years later. It's entirely common and typical that a developer would want to make these sort of adjustments over time to respond to the market, changing market conditions, and changing options with respect to development. So staff finds that this request is consistent with the Land Development Code and the Comprehensive Plan, and recommends that the Planning Board recommend the four proposed amendments to the current Master Plan Development, also referred to as the proposed First Amended and Restated Grand Landings Master Plan Development. In terms of next steps, should this be recommended, it would be two council meetings, March 20th, 9 a.m., and April 3rd at 6 p.m. So that concludes my presentation. You have questions?
Does the applicant have a presentation?
I believe they're available to respond to any questions, but
okay.
They have a formal presentation.
Thank you. Then we'll bring it to the board for any questions for any board members.
I just want to add one thing. The dates that but that's what we're anticipating dates will be. If those dates change, you know, of course, our red signs will show it and the newspaper will re-advertise. Those are dates that we're anticipating, so.
Okay. Questions from the board? Mr. Freeman?
What would be the average size of the rooms in the
back to the end of the floor beds, if you would. Uh-huh. Well, the coral is 35 feet wide by, looks to be 38 feet deep.
That's correct. There's 5 foot side setbacks. So you're looking at about 40 feet. Yeah, it's the same thing that sets on 50 foot lots. The rear and front setbacks, I believe, remain the same. The average square foot of the home is the same as it is for the 50 footers. We're running a minimum. The minimum square footage under our I believe it's our MPD, is 1,200 square feet per home. We're currently not even anywhere near that on the current homes, and I wouldn't anticipate that for here either.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Could we get name and address for the record?
Oh, well, I apologize. Jeffrey Douglas, 180 South Cape Court, Palm Coast.
So the average of a bedroom, a master bedroom?
It has to be a market driver. We're trying to, you know, open up a product range that would go from everybody from a retiree to a new single family to a single person. So a master bedroom is probably going to be 15 by 18 by 20. They may reduce it down, like my wife and I. We're only looking for a two-bedroom house, you know, from a three-bedroom. It might be three. You can see some of the product goes up to a 2-4 product. So, again, minimum square footage, I think we'll probably exceed that by some standard.
And that means the average for Palm Coast?
Palm Coast has a minimum 1,200 square foot house size. So yeah, this far exceeds the minimum. That's typically in Palm Coast.
Yeah, for the record, in our MPD, we're allowed to go down to 800 square feet on the attached housing. So if we did move forward with what we're allowed in, say, a townhome concept, the minimum on a townhome would be 800 square feet. So this is kind of introducing a product that would fit in between and allow space before jumping into the town.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Anything else?
Yeah, actually.
Peter?
I have a question. The reduction in the watt, width from 50 to 45, is this, what's the practical widening like that? And I'm guessing space and being able to build out to what you plan to build, and does this set any precedent for future, you know, variances to the 50-foot width?
No, I mean, no. Our code specifically states 50.
Yeah.
So, in order to make it less than 50, one, you have to modify your land development code, or number two, establish a development agreement.
Okay.
That has that exception, and that's recommended by planning board and ordinance through city council.
And the why kind of exception?
Just healthy community, diversity of housing, product type. It's not directed, you know, all age groups, all income types. It's just diversity of housing and absorption. You know, our goal, you know, ask any developer, our goal is to get it through as quickly as possible. You know, time is our enemy, and this just provides a needs market and a look forward to. You know, we had a big change last time where the housing market went to, 71 permits in 2011. We would prefer not to go there again. I think we're pulling more than that now on Grand Landings on an annual basis. So.
Even though you're reducing the minimum lot width to 45 feet, you're not changing the side setbacks?
No, sir. The same.
Good?
Yeah, okay.
My question is the same as the other. The reduction from 50 to 45 feet in our code calls it 50. What happens to all the extra land? It seems to be developing by you reducing them and then reducing the square footage of living space. Off in the home.
pocket parks, we just build it through. Or, you know, the other option is we go through and start stamping out townhomes. I mean, that's our options at the moment. If we want to go below 50 foot, we're going to start building townhomes. I mean, it's kind of a, at this time.
You mentioned clustering. By clustering, do you mean clustering homes closer together?
Well, by nature of 45 foot lots, you're going to put, let's just say we have a, for every, what's the math on that, for every, you can say 5 foot, so you're going to get an extra lot on every 100 feet. So therefore, if we did have extra land, it'd be a pocket park, it'd be a more common area, smaller common areas, but having more of them. A common area being an area of green space is another term for it.
Space, the space you say can't be used to build additional houses because you're limited by the number of units you can build.
That's correct. We'd have to come before you to make that change there.
But to me, it doesn't make any sense that we're going to give a reduction of that nature. And that's just, I mean, you're going to come up with extra room that they're still not going to be able to build one, but it's going to, why not give it to the people that are there? I mean, they're going to buy the homes. You know,
they might give them an opportunity at a low price point. Is that something that?
Yes, sir. Impact fees are fixed. They don't differentiate between the size of the home. So the person that builds on a 200-foot lot and a multi-million dollar home pays the same impact fees as the person that builds on a 50-foot lot or a 45-foot lot. A 45-foot lot is 5 less feet of front infrastructure, 5 less feet of pipe, 5 less feet of curb, 5 less feet of, you know, everything linear. So there's... And it's a different price point, so that's
so the theory is that you're going to hit a lower price point with
potentially
this.
yeah we could put more lipstick on it too,
yeah.
And you know, we could put demand pavers in the driveway with a carport. Not everybody wants to pay for, I mean, this is something you're going to have to deal with in the city. How big is the average city lot? 85 feet of frontage. How much frontage and sod does that soak up the water, groundwater? And what's that building going to look like? As the Florida goes under more and more water restrictions, how do you aquifer? You're going to be regulated. We all are. So if you want your community in 20 years to look good, people have enough extra money to put back in the house when it needs a new roof, put back in the house when it needs a new kitchen, put back in the driveway, you don't want to put and pump out $150 a month to water their lawn, or $100 a month because the cost is so high. You got a smaller, you know, area to do. It's healthier. We're looking to keep the drive through in 20 years. We're proud of it. We don't want to drive through in 20 years and go, man, all we did was X, Y, and Z because that was fashionable for the 5 year period we were doing it.
I have one question. I think I already know the answer, but just because this is the minimum, that doesn't mean that's every lot of ground is going to be this size. You have quite a variety already, don't you?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, we've got 60 footers. We've got 50 footers. They're selling very, very well. We've got 100 footers. We're doing the HBA Dream Home is going in there now on a 120 foot lot. So, and again, we've got townhomes that we're already approved for that we could pull out at any time, and that's, you know, I just assume not go in that, but I'm trying to be great to see that kind of product move into town center before it moves to us. So, and by the way, that's a minimum, so when we go in the cul-de-sac or something like that, you know, the lots tend to, they're going to average more than 45 feet, it's just a minimum. Yeah. Is it a foot or two? Is it 5 feet? It's some number greater than 45.
Good.
Okay, let's open it up to a public hearing. So any member from the public who would like to comment for or against this project, please approach the podium and give the secretary your name and address for the record.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Thomas Bell. Assuming all things are right in the world, at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, I will be the owner of a Grand Landings home in development number 3. Our experience dealing with the developer has been extremely difficult over the 9 months, 10 months since we've made a deposit on our home. At this point in time, we received a certificate of occupancy primarily through the efforts of the board and Mr. Ray Tyner and the gentlemen that do permits. Our lot, I believe, is a 60-foot wide lot. Our home has a three-car garage, which was our choice. There is an opportunity for a two-car garage home. Since this development started, it's my understanding that there was to be a lake on this property. And I specifically bought a home on a lot that had a lake or pond frontage to the rear of the home. That pond or lake does not yet exist. This developer has had this project approved, I believe, if I recall the notes correctly, since 2014 or perhaps 2015. So for those years up until today, there is no lake or pond to the rear of my home. However, there is a beautiful 8-foot chain link fence with black mesh that separates my property from a non-existent lake. And I presume that this request for rezoning is a matter of right by the applicant. If it's not, I have to sit here and say to myself, why is the board even considering this application when this developer has outstanding issues with developments that are underway and potentially, until yesterday, stopping certificates of occupancy for all the homes on South Cooper's Hawk Way whose property is adjacent to or abuts on, again, the non-existent lake. And that's...
Thank you. Seeing no one else approaching the podium, we'll close the issue to public hearing and bring it back to the board for questions. And I have one of Mr. Tyner. Is there a site plan that's been approved by us?
No, it was a plat, actually. The master plan development agreement was approved and recommended by city council. Wow. And yes, and then then it goes through each phase of that. We go through a technical preliminary plat with construction plans and review for each of the stages of the project. This was definitely an unfortunate situation. I know city staff, you know, we do never want to get to the point where we're holding up COs. We wanted the project in the lake to be constructed. I know the developer has had some setbacks with, like, a hurricane, for example. I know didn't anticipate that, but that was a setback. And, you know, and I worked with these folks to try to work with our construction management and engineering department to try to speed things up as much as practical. And I think it's a lesson learned. And I'm confident in the future that the developer and I, when we agree to something with some timelines, there's things that we're going to put in place to assure that this won't happen again. That's what we're trying to do.
Is there a lake or a pond planned for that?
Yeah, it's under construction now.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, it's under construction. And that's what we had to, you know, our concern was having residents in the adjacent houses that we really wanted a barrier in case there's toddlers or someone who could get out for life and safety purposes to protect them. But they're working on the lake, and we're hoping that lake is, you know, it's quite a big lake, so it's still under construction.
Okay. Okay, anybody else have questions for me?
I
got them, but we'll go this way first.
Does the developer have any response to the prospective homeowners' concerns?
Yes, Jeff Oates again, and thank you, Mr. Steiner, for working with staff. We had the lake was designed for phase 3A and 3B. We had agreement to go ahead and move forward with the development upon phase 3A being built. 3A pond was built with 3B to follow right in that. We got a hurricane, which, as you know, prior to the hurricane, Army Corps of Engineers on a federal level, how deep in the labor pains do you want to know on this one? I can get as deep as you want to go. But Army Corps of Engineers enacted where they demanded site inspection for the first time in my career. So 15, 20 years. So the Army Corps, we couldn't start moving the dirt and obtain that final permit until the Corps was out there to inspect the wetlands, move the dirt for the balance of the lake. Construction started, hurricane hits, tried to get a Corps or federal person out there for a mandatory site inspection, which has never happened before. And all they typically did was agree with St. John's and the city's delineations. So, and of course, that went off without a hitch once they got out there. So you add all those up and you're 120 days late, and that's what happened. I apologize to you. I had my son out there. We spent all the money putting the fence in. We did everything to accommodate staff. Staff was great. So the reason looking at the fence is because there's no way that you would have got a CO unless they put that fence up. So the fence will come down. And we, from the developer's part of client construction, instead of running two excavators or one excavator and one end dump, we're running six end dumps, two excavators in there digging that pond. So we'll probably hit a record in Palm Coast for the fastest pond of that size being dug. So we'll be done in probably 2 weeks. So if you're worried about how much money we spent, close to $25,000 putting that up, I do dearly apologize. Believe me, we had no intention of delaying you, and we were very sensitive of it. You want to move in. We wanted to do everything we could to get you in, and that's shame on us for that delay. But the pond is about 90% on the pond. We got to get the rest of the material out there. So it's a major undertaking. When it's done, we'll be on a beautiful pond with a wetland behind that. So long story.
I'm not saying that you don't do it, but would you find it in the future useful to have some sort of an update, a newsletter, some kind of outreach to those potential owners?
Yes, ma'am.
To give them some kind of idea of where we are now. You must have an office manager or a construction manager in simple terms, some bullet point information to homeowners or potential homeowners to say, here's where we are. And here's what we expect in the next 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 2 months, whatever it might be. So if that's not being done, I would suggest that you consider it.
Okay. Well, thank you. You're with yourself.
Thank you.
What?
The developer stated 50-foot lots are selling real well.
I'm not sure that's what he said. Everybody said that the existing lots were
50 foot. And I'm not in favor of changing the code myself to 45 feet. Our code is giving exceptions.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, just to be clear, we're not changing the code. This is just for this project.
I have no questions. Okay. So we would need a motion to approve the agenda.
Make a motion to disapprove the agenda item.
Mr. Chair.
I don't think you can do that.
I think it's hard to vote on a disapprove because then people don't know what exactly they're yes. I would just suggest maybe, Mr. Davis, that if you are against it, that you vote to approve it and you move to approve it but then vote against it.
Someone else.
Okay, you still need a motion.
I'll move to approve the ordinance.
further discussion? Okay, would you call the roll?
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Mrs. Lucas?
Yes.
Mr. Lenhart?
Yes.
Mr. Scully?
Yes.
Mr. Davis?
Yes.
Mr. Jones?
Yes.
The motion carries.
Thank you. Okay, agenda item 1, 2, 3 is Sawmill Creek and Compost Park, a subdivision master plan application number 3473. Mr. Tite.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is exciting for us. This is when we had a downturn in an economy and things kind of ceased and didn't develop. You may recall there was a large subdivision with a golf course up in the off of US 1 called Sawmill. And then, you know, they had a blat and, you know, kind of the market went down. So we are really seeing a whole lot of activity in the Palm Coast Park area. And the reason I call it Palm Coast Park, and Mr. Hoover will give you some of the details, but it is part of what we call the development of regional impact. And it is a large plan development that was not only approved, final approval by our city council, but also looked upon by and approved upon recommendations of approval by all the different agencies from the Department of Environmental Protection, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission, the Regional Planning Council up in Jacksonville, the Department of Environmental Protection, St. John's River Water Management District, the Florida Fish and Wildlife, probably said that, and the Florida Department of Transportation, the school board, the sheriff's office looks at it, the joining counties look at this development as well and was approved. Part of that approval is a certain amount of entitlements that are given to this large development. This is just a piece of it. This is our first residential development within the Palm Coast Park area. And this is the first phase. It is a single-family subdivision. And with that said, Mr. Hoover will have some of those details.
Good evening. Bill Hoover from the Planning Division. The Palm Coast Park DRI is 4,677 acres, and it's primarily located on both sides of US 1. There's a total of 3,960 homes approved in there. And the Sawmill Creek is more particularly located about two-thirds of a mile north of Batanzas Woods Parkway on the west side of Sawmill, the west side of US 1. And it's a 110-acre site. And you can see the faded area where I think there's a lot of cypress trees in there. And so that's where Hewlett Branch runs, along the west side of the property going up to the top of the map. And then it follows the property boundary over and hits US 1. And so actually that branch flows to the north, and then the Matanzas Woods community flows to the west underneath US 1 and goes along the side of this project. Track 6A and 6B is where the subdivision master plan is located. The yellow area there is designated residential. And you can see a little bit of green along the west property boundary, which would be wetland areas running along the branch. This is a layout of the proposed community. There's 259 lots. A little over half of those are 50 foot wide, and then about one-third of them are 60 foot wide. And the lot sizes range anywhere from 6,000 square feet, and there's a lot of them in that 7,000, 8,000, even 9,000 range. Overall density is 2.36 units per acre, which is similar probably to a low-density single-family community. You can see there's an amenity center in, about an acre and a half in the center of the location. The project has two access points that's required on US 1. There's four lakes that are interconnected, and they'll have two locations where the outfall for the lakes will drain into the wetlands along Hewlett Branch. And then next to the wetlands going along Hewlett Branch, which is the blue line there, sort of the center line, you'll see some darker areas there. And for instance, right there, so the darker gray area is a upland buffer that's next to the wetlands. And I think the purpose, correct me if I'm wrong, Denise, I think the purpose of the upland buffer is to keep things out of the wetlands, and if you got runoff, let's say, from fertilizer and stuff, it would catch it there before it got into the wetlands. And staff's required to review each development order that comes in for five key criteria, and which A, must not be in conflict with the public interest, must be consistent with both the Unified Land Development Code and the Comprehensive Plan. It must not impose a significant liability or hardship on the city, must not create an unreasonable hazard or nuisance, and E, must comply with all applicable government standards, including federal and state. And so we reviewed these. It'd probably be a little bit boring, went through all in detail, but we explored these in detail in the staff report. And in summary, though, the subdivision will not create a nuisance, hazard, or any compatibility issues as it meets all the development standards. And the residential uses meet all the standards in the Palm Coast Park DRI, Palm Coast Park MPD, and there's also public infrastructure in place along the west side of US 1 adjacent to the site, including public water, public sewer, and even reuse water for irrigation. And the project also meets all the requirements in the Land Development Code and Comprehensive Plan. Planning staff recommends that the Planning Board approve a Tier 2 subdivision master plan for Sawmill Creek at Palm Coast Park, application number 3473. There's actually a couple of minor conditions on there that I wasn't aware of until like very late today. And one is more like an environmental, I guess you would call it, just be a informational purposes only, and the other one was regarding the one access that I think the applicant has talked to LTOT, and basically the staff saying that the access points may not be as quite as shown on the subdivision master plan because LTOT has the right to review and comment on those access points.
And if I may, Bill, just to, you know, this is, when we changed our land development code in 2008, actually the planning board recommended that they see the subdivision master plan if it's over 50 units for residential homes. Historically, we didn't do that. You know, the NPD kind of shows the layout. But basically, this is the first step of a three-step process. They turn in a master plan, and it's really a general review. Does it look like it's going to work? Are there some major wetlands that are going to be impacted? We look at the big picture. And that's why, you know, FDOT will look at that master plan, and, you know, they go through the details. But when you do the preliminary plat, that's when you start getting a lot of those details, the transportation, the hard engineering with the preliminary plat. And then after that, the third stage is what we call final plat, and that's approved by city council. So this is a general look Yes, we think it can happen. Staff recommends approval to go on to the next stage. We don't see anything that's, giving us a black eye, so to speak. And we kind of try to work out those issues before the master plan gets to you, if there are any, like environmental issues, for example.
I can read what the environmental issue is specifically. And I'm pretty certain the applicant's engineers are aware of this. Extent of the special flood hazard area and associated base flood elevation shall be established during preliminary plat review. And on the traffic study, the concept shows two entrances, but only one has a full access median. The northernmost access is only shown as a right in, right out, and there is no northbound left shown entering the facility. Please remove the northbound left at the northernmost entrance. That's probably the best one of looking at this. And Bill Schaefer, the applicant's engineer from Dominion Engineering, is here to my left. If he wants to comment on that, or if you have any specific questions for him.
Thank you, Bill. Bill Schaefer, Dominion Engineering Group.
Sorry, sir. Name and address.
Yes, next. 4348 South Point Boulevard, Suite 204, Jacksonville, Florida. First, I'd just like to thank staff for, we've had an opportunity to work with staff on this, and everyone's just been a real, real delight to work with. Everyone's been very excited about helping us and very responsive. Submitting the master plan was the first time I submitted under the regulations here in the city, and there was a lot of unique things about it, and everyone was very helpful. We did a TRX just to kind of go over our overall site plan, and there was a lot of very good information provided to us. And one of the things that we talked about was, of course, the access points on the project. So we met with FDOT, and they had some requirements for us to do some initial traffic study and some analysis, and we did those and provided that information to them. A part of the subdivision master plan is also we provide a full traffic study for the city to look at, and we did, in fact, provide that for the city to look at. And so that information was provided, and we show directional on the northbound. And so if you look at the coming out, there's sort of like a little triangle, which is sort of like we call a pork chop sometimes in this business, where it's an elevated directional, where the out would not be a left turn out, it would only be a right out. So it's directional. So if you were going north on US Highway 1, you could take a left in, but you wouldn't be able to take a left out from Subdivision and go northbound. They'd have to go down to the main exit or take a right and turn around at the new medium break. I've heard the comments and conditions. We're very fine and comfortable with those. And if there's any questions y'all have for me, I stand by to respond to those.
Anybody have any questions for the staff or the developer?
Yeah. I just have some comments. I know I spoke with Ray prior to the start of the meeting. Our questions, concerns, and I know that it will be answered, is the trigger for when the land would be given to the school board. I know we have a track that's already been set for that. I think that's 10B, and Mr. Schaefer wants to reach out. He called me this afternoon, and I didn't get a chance to talk to him, but to reach out and look at maybe another possible piece to the school board to look at again. And then my only other comment would be that we look forward to looking at the details, the preliminary plat for transportation and bus stops and flow as well. So just comments, I guess.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, I'm glad Mr. Freeman brought that up, because part of the DRI process in this case was the main, the primary developer was required to provide a school site. So if it's not part of this track, but the next track that their next phase is, I think they're under discussion with the school board to maybe relocate that site or keep it where it is, where Bill has it kind of highlighted. But those discussions, if that school site is to change, of course, Mr. Freeman said his board needs to approve it, and then we would have to modify the development agreement for the DRI, which you would see, you know, to make that recommendation to City Council. So,
is this a site plan what we're looking at?
This is a master development plan.
Okay. It, we will see a site plan.
No, the for this, after this phase, it's highly technical, where what you see here on the subdivision layout, after this, they provide construction plans. And those construction plans are a staff review of, you know, the stormwater, the water, the sewer, all the underground, the lakes, all the roads, and those details. And it will generally look like what the subdivision layout plan is. After the preliminary plat is approved, the next and final step, which is required by state law, is that City Council approves the final plat. And on the final plat, that's where you have easements and the lot dimensions, and that's what's actually recorded. Addresses are set on those properties, and that's actually what's recorded, and they're, after the final plat, they're ready to sell those lots.
This was a development 8 or 10 years ago, Sawmill Creek.
Yes, it was. And that one is, this ain't the same developer. It's the same name they kept. I think it's a similar name, but different developer. And if you recall, a long time ago, Sawmill originally had a golf course.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
And that went through the whole, I think it was close to the final plat. It didn't quite get there. But of course, you know, golf courses aren't in 2018.
That's so, right across the US.
Yeah, they're doing it without a golf course. So.
Any other questions for the staff, for the developer? Okay, we're going to open the meeting up to public comment. Any member of the public who would like to speak on this subject, for or against, please approach the podium, state your name and address for the record, and we'd be glad to hear you. Line up. Let's roll it on. Okay, so seeing no one approach the podium, we'll close the public hearing. Bring it back to the board for discussion, if there is any, or vote.
Will be part of the presentation to give you some good background and some history of this project.
Good evening, board members. Good to be here with you tonight again. I think the last time I was here was on another redevelopment project, which was Island Walk. So, young city, but another opportunity for a redevelopment project. Just a little bit of background before Mr. Hoover gets into the technical details. This project is within the State Road 100 Community Redevelopment Area. That was started in 2004 and really focused on really these two subdivisions, the one along Bulldog Drive being known as Midway. Originally platted in the, I believe, late 60s, 70s, dirt roads, no water, sewer, well and septic, originally as a residential subdivision, kind of pre-Palm Coast, not really to Palm Coast standards. So the city enacted the CRA in order to start eliminating some of that slum and blight, assemble property for future redevelopment. And so after 2004, the city was able to acquire a good number of the parcels. And then, of course, we went through the recession and things slowed down a little bit. And then as the economy picked back up, city council directed myself and staff to really take a hard look at what are the possible options for redevelopment. And so in 2016, the city issued a request for proposals for developer partners to help us assemble some additional property and start redeveloping one of our main entrances into this downtown area you're in now. Unicorp, under the name Palm Town Center, was our best response from a very credible and good developer that's done a lot of great projects like the I in International Drive. And so the city entered into a purchase and sales agreement to make this redevelopment project happen. Since that time in 16, staff and the developer have been working through a number of issues that come through a project that's a redevelopment of this scale and magnitude. It's often easier to build something new than try to remodel your house. So think of that on a development scale. So just wanted to give you that little bit of background. I think before you is a very good proposal to get jump-started development, turning the corner into our downtown. And with that, I'm available for any questions on the economic development side, but really you're here tonight for the technical side of the rezoning. And just please understand that sometimes it's a lot easier to develop a green piece of property and meet every one of the standards than to take a project that was pre-Palm Coast and make it fit. But I think staff and the developer have done a very good job of making a good-looking project.
Good evening again. Bill Hoover from Planning Division. The project is actually a total of 9.09 acres, and I just want to make you aware there are a couple properties that are outside the yellow, and one is up here, and then there's another one here, and then another one here. So there's three property owners with a total of, like seven lots that are not part of the rezoning, but those projects may come in this redevelopment area in the future. And the two properties to the south are actually zoned Comm2 General Commercial. And the future land use element shows that the subject property is zoned mixed, or I'm sorry, is designated mixed use on the future land use map. The high school to the west is designated institutional, and the land directly to the east of the Midway subdivision is also, and outside the seven lots I mentioned, those are designated DRI Urban Core, and they're part of the Town Center DRI. And then you can see to the northeast, there's a large parcel that's a little bit odd shape, and it's designated conservation because this area that won't be developed. You can see the existing zoning map on the left. The subject property is both Comm2 on the south, public, semi-public on the north, and then the high school is public, semi-public, and then you can see the town center MPD to the east and the north and northeast.
project is intended to be developed in two phases, and you can see a phase line there. And in phase one would house a Wawa convenience store with gas pumps along the side facing State Route 100. And there would be a stormwater pond located in the area just where it says phase line. This is sort of a blow up of phase one, and it's a preliminary site plan. We asked Wawa, the developers representing Wawa, to prepare a preliminary site plan because the lot area, since we couldn't get the five commercial lots to the east, it makes this site too narrow to really develop without some a lot of work. So Midway Drive, you can see there is a 50-foot right-of-way. Back in the old days, I guess some of them were 50-foot. And the west 24 feet is proposed to be vacated. Now, that proposal will go direct to the city council when we have the first read of this MPD rezoning. So, but on the other hand, I need to explain that to you so that you can see how this is fitting in here. So you can see that the west 24 feet within the north arrow is going to the west in this case. So the west 24 feet would be vacated and used towards development of the Wawa facility. And then the developer would pave the remaining 26 feet. And then as that road got to the approaching the stormwater pond, you can see another road going to the west towards Bulldog Drive. And that would be, that's on some city property, and the city council has basically allowed that property to be used for this purpose. And so this would allow the neighbors to also drive down Midway Drive and then catch the left and go out to Bulldog Drive. Or kids coming from the high school would be, I think there's a left in there where they come in at that point also. So one of the deviations that we have for this, the building itself, is that we have a architectural standard, and we've been reviewing our code, and we've noticed this is not the first project that's had that development. But what's happened is air conditioners have gotten a lot larger because they're more efficient. Most commercial developers put those on the roof, but we have a standard that only allows the parapet wall to be 15% above the supporting wall. So you can't hide the air conditioner if you limit it with the 15%. So we're asking that there be a deviation on this so it goes to 25 feet so that the building will look more aesthetic. And on the previous one, I want to point out there's three deviations on that we're requesting. The first one is that the canopy, which would be over the gas pumps, is supposed to have a 10-foot setback from the neighboring property lines. In this case, it would only be 5 feet. Now, the canopy has trucks basically go up to about 14 feet in height max. And in this case, the canopy would have a clearance of 14 feet, 11 inches, if I'm not mistaken. So it's not like somebody's going to drive by and hit it because the vehicles aren't allowed to go that high. Anyway, if it did go off the road. The monument sign along Bulldog Drive right away, normally those are set back 10 feet. We've got a city sign that they're trying to miss. It's a... It's more like an entry sign for the town center. And so we're asking for that setback to be reduced from 10 feet to 5 feet. And on the monument signs, what's a little bit funny here is the wider your property, the more frontage you have, the bigger the sign you get. However, in this case, a bigger monument sign would be allowed on Bulldog Drive, which is more of a collector-type roadway and the entrance into the community. So we've suggested, and they don't have much frontage on State Route 100, so we suggested to them
that we would offer to give them, allow them to move the bigger sign to State Route 100 because of the width of the roadway and all the extra traffic, and it's not quite needing to be as aesthetic, let's say, as Bulldog Drive as the entrance into town center. On the canopy, we have another one that we're asking for a deviation on, and essentially in this case, the maximum canopy clearance is 15 feet, and this meets it, but we're asking for this to be clarified. There's actually a metal bar that keeps something from being over 15 feet tall, and it's actually right there. And it goes across there, and you can also see it down here. So we're just clarifying that the maximum canopy clearance would be measured from that rather than the top of the roof. And on the landscaping land, there's not a buffer along Midway Drive, and the intention really is for Midway Drive to actually end up being a parking aisle drive like you would see maybe going into Target or one of those bigger centers, and generally you don't have a buffer next to the parking aisle roadway coming in there. And when this gets into phase two, probably the balance of Midway Drive will be vacated, and then this access drive that goes that connects Midway Drive to Bulldog Drive, there will actually be another one or two more access drives going up there. So essentially, the internal roadway system will be more like a commercial 24, 26 foot wide two-way access drive. And then there will be utility easements next to that for utilities. Again, we review projects according to section 2.0505 of the Land Use and Development Code. And there's five criteria. A, must not be in conflict with public interest. B, must be consistent with the Unified Land Development Code and comprehensive plan. C, must not pose a significant liability or hardship on the city. D, must not create an unreasonable hazard or nuisance. And E, must comply with all applicable government standards. Again, the details are in the staff report. In this case, the MPD rezoning would not create a nuisance hazard or any compatibility issues as it meets all development standards and is in compliance with its mixed-use designation on the future land use map. And the redevelopment of this site is consistent with numerous policies in the future land use element, which actually support redevelopment and give flexibility to standards when you're doing redevelopment or you have a highly unique site, which this site obviously qualifies for. And the project also meets all standards of the Gateway Overlay Zone, which comprises this area going over to the east to the Whispering Pines subdivision. For public participation, staff put up three signs, two on Bulldog Drive, one on State Route 100. We notified all property owners within 300 feet, and we held a meeting with representatives of the applicant. Four persons attended. They had some concerns, and I believe those were pretty much fully addressed at that meeting or during the week that followed. Planning staff recommends that the planning board recommend the city council approval to rezone the property from general commercial COM 2 and PSP to Palm Town Center MPD as outlined in the MPD Development Agreement application number 3448. And the representatives for the developer are here if you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hoover. Does the applicant have a presentation? Or are you just here for questions? Let's start out.
Brent Mulligan with Unicorp National Developments, 7940 via the Lazio Way. So 7940 Via Delacia Way, Orlando, 32819. My name is Brett Mulligan. We don't have a presentation though.
Okay, great. So if we have any questions, we'll come back to you. So we'll bring it back to the board for any questions for the applicant or the staff. Mr. Freeman?
My question or comment is, I know that this is a concept sketch, I believe. Will we get a chance to talk with the developer, especially the school, the high school that's there, to as far as coming back, how they will access back onto Bulldog Road? Because the way that it looks like the access road, looks like you might be able to swing back and go south on Bulldog Road to 100, and I know during school times that can get like backed up. So we would just want to have an opportunity to be able to work with them on that.
There's to the north of Phase 1 by that yellow line that you can see, there's going to be a road we're going to put in. There's going to be a left and right turn out on the Bulldog.
But Mr. Freeman, once we get into more of the detail, absolutely, we need to sit with you. And
yeah, I'd like for somebody to sit down with the principal who has to deal with it every day.
Yeah. Agreed. So the technical site plan, where we get into the engineering details, has not been submitted, but I think they're getting reasonably close to that. They have provided a proposed crosswalk in case students want to walk across Bulldog Drive and go to the Wawa store, which we figured might possibly happen.
I guarantee you that's going to happen.
Well, if I can add, Mr. Tyner, you know, as far as the school goes, you know, the city has been quite a partner with FPC there, and Bulldog Drive, as it looks today, is not how it looked several years ago, and I think even the city spent about $5.5 million, including funds on school board property to redo the parking. So I know we'll continue those conversations because we've invested too much to make that area what it looks like today. So I think that'll continue.
The plan will plug into the loop, the school board, when we get to that point of the process, right? Yeah. Same. Any other questions from the board? Thank you, sir. Going to now open it to public comment. Anyone from the public who would like to speak on this subject, either for or against, please approach the podium. Seeing no one approach the podium, we're going to close the public portion of the meeting and bring it back to the board for a discussion or a vote. Anything to add from any of the board members? Could you use a motion?
I would move, Mr. Chairman, that the PLDRB recommend approval to the City Council to rezone the property to master plan development, including the attached development agreement.
Awesome. And second, number eight, are you in Chipotle roll?
Yes.
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 Mr. Scott?
Yes.
Mr. Davis?
Yes.
Yes.
Chairman, the motion carries.
Thank you. Very well. Congratulations. Final evening's agenda item is a proposed rewrite of the Land Development Code Section 10.02 floodplain ordinance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We workshopped this with you, I don't know when it was, about a month ago. Was
it last meeting?
Yep. Yeah, the last meeting we did, yeah.
Right
there. And we, you know, we met with stakeholders, the Volusia / Flagler County Association of Responsible Developments, Home Builders Association representatives, and, you know, all the stakeholders, developers, attorneys. And with that, Denise Bevan has an update of those discussions, and we're here to get your motion for City Council.
Thank you, Mr. Tyner. Denise Bevan, City Administration Coordinator, and I also serve as the city's lead floodplain manager. So just to go over as an overview about why I'm here tonight giving this presentation and the city's participation in the National Flood Insurance Program. So Palm Coast has participated in the NFIP since 2002, and the provision for our citizens to be able to have flood insurance is participation in the NFIP, and also to have a community eligible for federal disaster funds. And the NFIP requires that the communities adopt and enforce the minimal standards or exceed minimal standards for the NFIP standards. Communities are encouraged to participate in the community rating system. That's a volunteer program for communities that aim to reduce risk through different activities, which in turn reduces flood insurance premiums for our citizens. So dating back to 2002, as I noted, City of Palm Coast was accepted into the NFIP, and duly at that time, we looked at participating in the community rating system. And in 2004, we achieved the CRS Class 7. The way that the classes work is that 10 is basically minimum requirements for the National Flood Insurance Program, and 1 is the best. And so over time, we increased our CRS rating. As noted, in 2009, in Class 6, part of that was adopting the Land Development Code and some higher standards. In 2014, a Class 5. And as Mr. Tyner mentioned, we did meet with FCARB representatives and BCARB representatives in April 2017, and we're very proud on May 1st in 2017, we achieved a CRS Class 4. And at that time, which I believe is still valid, there's only 12 other communities in the whole United States that have that rating or higher. Just over New Year's Eve, effective January 1, Florida Building Code, the 6th edition, which has a host of floodplain regulations now, became effective. And something coming very soon on June 6th, Flagler County will be receiving new flood insurance rate maps, and they will take effect on that day. And I didn't mention as going through the class, but parallel to the dates and the activity, you'll notice a reduction in the premiums for citizens located in special flood hazard areas. That's what we deem as the regulatory floodplain. So the goal of this ordinance is to remain consistent with the NFIP standards. We also, of course, are keeping our higher standards and making sure that the regulations now speak to the Florida Building Code. We had the great benefit of the Florida Division of Emergency Management. They've progressively, over the years, created a state model ordinance and have been our liaison to make sure that we're consistent with FEMA regulations and our higher standards are migrated into this ordinance. And, of course, making sure that our CRS program is strong and that this ordinance doesn't undermine any of those standards. So today, the last time we were in front of the board was January 17. We've had 3 total meetings with the Flagler County Association for Responsible Development, FCARD. That was on April 13, 2017, January 25, 2018, and most recently, February 15. Staff has been consolidating comments over this time, and we'll be going over those comments in the upcoming slides, but we have transmitted the information to the Florida Division of Emergency Management and our points of contact for the community rating system. So just a quick tutorial for the benefit of the board and the public. For the City of Palm Coast, we have the following flood zones within our municipal boundaries currently. And just as a general statement, the whole state of Florida is in a floodplain. When someone says, are you in the floodplain, everybody's in one floodplain designation or another. But when we're talking about this ordinance, we're really focusing on what's called special flood hazard areas. And so we have A zones, which are basically high-risk areas by flood insurance purposes. Those are not studied by FEMA. They're just generally determined by different methods. AE has been studied by FEMA, and those zones actually have what's called a base flood elevation established. So a special flood hazard area has been deemed to be an area that is, can experience a 1% chance of annual flood. I'm sure the board's heard before, 100-year flood. We don't like that term because when people hear 100-year flood, they said, oh, Irma, we're good for another 99 years. So it's really about 1% annual chance of flood. And where that comes down to is establishes that standard for a base flood elevation. Again, that's for AE zones. The most sensitive part of the regulated flood zones are floodways. Those are a creek, a stream, a conveying water body. X-shaded are not part of the regulatory floodplain designations. Those are outside the special flood hazard area, and they're a 0.2% annual chance of flood. Usually you see those right on the peripheral of an AE zone. And then finally, everything else is an X. That's where FEMA has established a minimal chance of flood. This all goes back to flood insurance. And so when we talk about flood zones, we don't say, hey, you're never going to flood because you're in an X. It's just the determination that drives flood insurance premiums and our regulations, as you're going to hear tonight.
But reading down from that chart, as you read down from that chart, our citizens' insurance premiums will also go down. If you're located in an X, you're going to pay the minimum flood insurance. If you're located in an AE,
excellent point, yes. So at X-Zone, we do encourage everybody in the city of Palm Coast to secure flood insurance because there's no other way to really rebound from an unfortunate circumstance of flooding. X-Zones, if you do not have a repetitive loss, there's some other prerequisites. You can qualify for what's called a preferred risk policy. That preferred risk policy is standardized by basically your square footage and your assets. It's established by Congress, so you can go to any service provider and you're going to get the same quote, and that's for an X zone. But exactly right on point, once you get into those higher risk areas, A and AE zones, it radically goes up.
But you said everywhere in Florida is in a flood zone.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Good point. Because a lot of times people say to you, well, am I okay in the flood zone? The answer is yes, but is it a bad one or a good one?
It's a good one.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely. Great question. So on June 6th, as I mentioned, Flagler County, of course, City of Palm Coast will be issued and will have effective new maps. They do look a little different than what we've had before. With the new maps, I thought it would be important just to kind of go over some of those zones. You'll notice that I've used where Palm Harbor Parkway here, and this is where the College Waterway is here, and this is Long Creek Nature Preserve over here. And basically what you're seeing there is a coastal influenced flood hazard area, which is the blue, integrating with our saltwater canals, but also interfacing with Big Mulberry Branch, which is right here, which is a regulatory floodway. So this is a great depiction of seeing what AE zones are, floodways, and then also that 0.2% chance of annual flood, which is on the peripherals of the AE zone. That's a light pale orange color. And so jumping into the ordinance and some of the highlights from what we're doing with the ordinance, wanted to talk about some of the more critical areas and some of the features that we went over with the stakeholders. Have to mention that this ordinance is nothing new, per se. We've enhanced the language. We've worked with Florida Division of Emergency Management to really try to bring a little bit of clarity to the ordinance, so it does change. The first area that I'd like to just bring the board's attention to is a 25-foot floodway setback development standard. The purpose is to minimize encroachments into these areas. Again, just to remind the board, these are your creeks, your natural systems that do behave differently than what you would see in a canal. Where we really affect development is that if you encroach into that 25-foot setback, we do require additional analysis. That floodway is changing. And just to home in on a couple of the areas that are natural in intent from the ordinance. We have Big Mulberry Branch, which we were just focusing in, and we also have Yellow Creek. That's our two natural floodways that are currently within our boundaries. And this is a mirror image. To the left, we're looking at basically the FEMA floodway, which is basically this purple squiggly line. That's your floodway. I did a very poor job of aligning that. But the blue is actually what the city of Palm Coast has as land holding. So we worked very hard to acquire those parcels that would be in jeopardy of a higher risk of flood because of it being the floodway. And then to the right is just a zoning depiction of where that natural floodway extends. Again, it pops off into College Waterway, but it actually is influenced all the way to 95. And we do consider this floodway important not just because it's natural and a conveying feature, but it is critically connected to our stormwater system as well. When we talk about better data, this is a snapshot from one of our other efforts to improve stormwater management in the city. It's a LIDAR graphic. And in March of 2017, the city, with the assistance of the St. John's River Water Management District, actually had the whole city surveyed by LIDAR technology. And that's basically where a plane flies over. It emits a laser pulse. It comes back and it tells you the elevations. And we're really excited about this for numerous reasons, but for tonight, just wanted to show this as how different what FEMA shows and what possibly is on the ground. The blue is the lowest elevations. It's very difficult to see, but there's somewhat of little crevices, and that's really where the water flows. And then, of course, the green is the higher elevations. So what we're really wanting to focus on is that we know these are dynamic systems that can change, and this would provide, you know, those assurances over time that we can protect the floodway and our citizens. These are the areas that these parcels exist. They're improved. There's two more here that are vacant. And just to bring attention to what we, of course, do not own, but may be affected by this ordinance. The secondary floodway is down south, Buell, that's south of 100, east of 95. The beauty of this floodway, it's completely comprised within the Old Kings Road South DRI, and we've been actively working with the applicant to make sure all the protections are dealt with as part of that development. We do not foresee any problems with this development standard. Clarification on development standards. Site plans and constructions by reference 10.0207, established base flood elevations according to the scale of the project. Additional analysis required based on location of development, i.e. floodway, riverine, flood hazard areas, alteration of water course. The applicant shall submit the analysis to FEMA for a letter of map change. A letter of map change is basically a term used when a project changes basically a flood zone or a flood determination, or if what FEMA determined to be a certain zone or a certain designation and they got it wrong, and you can actually go through the process and officially change it so it reflects on the map and any records that FEMA oversees. For site improvements, utilities, and limitations by reference 10.0213, compensatory storage for any reduction in water holding capacity of a flood hazard area. Our concern, and this is not anything new, is that when a project is developed in a special flood hazard area, basically it compensates for its impact and it doesn't basically impact offsite properties. You don't flood your neighbor. Subdivision plats, this is where we added a lot of clarity by reference 10.0212. Establish that base flood elevation data. So a lot of our special flood hazard area within our municipal boundaries have never been studied. A lot of A zones. And so subdivisions would be required to establish the BFE, again, compliance with the compensatory storage, and ensuring that the BFE and any additions or modifications be transmitted through FEMA and letter of map change determination would be secured. What's so important about this provision is that when a subdivision comes in, the developer has the ability to do that study. It gets platted, a final plat occurs, and those residents are not in the special flood hazard area. And to your point, Mr. Chair, they don't face those intense premiums, and it's all avoided up front. Critical facilities. This is where you have your shelters, your police stations, your fire stations. Obviously, you don't want those services in high-risk area. It also considers towers and communications. We do not want those new critical facilities in the special flood hazard area. However, we do acknowledge that sometimes the property is what it is. There is mechanisms to study the area. A letter of map change would be required, and the whole project would be removed from the special flood hazard area. And so, ultimately, if a critical facility had to be constructed in a special flood hazard area, we would have assurances from FEMA that they would not be in a high-risk area. So the feedback we received from FCAR, specifically the compensatory storage, and we just went over the references, 1002.12b4 and 1002.13d, compensatory storage for any reduction in water holding capacity of the flood hazard area. The feedback that we received is that the stakeholders would appreciate that mention to the storage to be on-site or off-site. And so when they do the higher analysis through the engineering, that it can be demonstrated that even though the project is within a limited boundary, the watershed is much bigger, and so they can do other activities to offset their impact, as long as it didn't affect the whole watershed or the floodplain. So as a result of that feedback, staff did request FDM, again, Florida Division of Emergency Management, and our CRS technical experts to look at that addition and make sure it wasn't going to undermine the NFIP standards or higher standards. To date, we have not received the analysis from those parties. Letter of map change definitions. We had a stakeholder acknowledge that there was many different letter of map change mechanisms in addition to what we had identified in our definition. So FCAR feedback was add language to better accommodate other types of letter of map changes. And this is what that would look like. An official determination issued by FEMA that amends or revises an effective flood insurance rate map or flood insurance study. Letters of map change include but not limited to. Again, we transmitted that to FDEM and our CRS technical experts for an opinion on if it was acceptable to use that language. We don't foresee that to be an issue. In addition to looking into the ordinance, working with FDM, making sure that we're meeting our higher standards, of course, we want to reflect on a comprehensive plan, making sure that the ordinance aligns with objectives and policies. So we'll just go through these slides fairly quickly. But objective 6.1.12, floodplain protection, maintain the hydrological and ecological function of floodplain areas by reducing loss of flood storage capacity and protecting the functional value of wetlands. 6.1.12.1, the city shall enforce land development regulations, amend the LDC as necessary to specify limitations to the encroachment, setbacks, buffer zones, alteration, and incompatible land uses, and design of storm event floodplains. At a minimum, the city shall include the following criteria as a basis for protection of 100-year floodplains. Minimization of flood damage and related losses by prohibiting new development within the 100-year floodplains unless the structures are elevated, lowest first floors are floodproofing, and provide compensatory storage, which the ordinance acknowledges. Policy 6.1.12.1, protection of appropriate floodplain areas by land acquisition or conservation easements. As described in the Bibbo Bear Branch, we, of course, look to that right now. According to the existing flood maps, 59% of the special flood hazard areas in Palm Coast are protected forever. Minimum standards for drainage from developments within 100-year floodplains reduce impacts on adjoining properties or degradation of the quality of receiving surface water bodies. Policy 6.1.12.2, the city shall continue to participate in the FEMA CRS program, which involves meeting higher than minimal National Flood Insurance Program. Policy 6.1.12.3, The city's LDC shall be reviewed annually to ensure that it's consistent with the latest available regulations promulgated by the FEMA to reduce property damage and loss of life due to flooding. We believe we've done this through this ordinance. Lastly, 6.1.12.4. The city shall protect the natural functions of the 100-year floodplain so that flood carrying capacity are maintained and enforcing floodplain regulations and reviewing development proposals for the presence of impacts on floodplains. Overall, considering these comprehensive plan policies, we believe the ordinance is consistent. And finally, for staff recommendation, planning staff recommends that POVRB recommend to the City Council to adopt this ordinance with amendments if found acceptable by the commenting entities. Through this whole process, working with Florida Division of Emergency Management, they've been very sensitive to any changes that happen within the ordinance, because we have a rare opportunity that they've been delegated from FEMA the ability to accept this ordinance on behalf of FEMA. So any changes, we are very sensitive to, so we want to get feedback from those commenting entities. But if they do accept, these would be the following three changes in the ordinance beyond what you have tonight. 10.02.12.B.4, we would add mitigation may be provided through on-site and off-site activities. That's reflected on compensatory storage. Same for 10.02.13.D, add mitigation may be provided through on-site or off-site activities. And finally, modify the definition for letter of map change and include but not limited to. And for next steps, if PLDRB does recommend for this to move forward, we do have some anticipated dates for City Council consideration. On March 27th, City Council workshop. April 3rd, go to first reading. April 17th, second reading at City Council business. And finally, all this is leading up to that effective date of June 6th for the new flood insurance rate maps, which is acknowledged in the ordinance. With that, appreciate any questions or comments that the board may have.
Thank you, Denise. I feel like you have an uphill battle. I mean, all these technical changes in the documentation have nothing to do with the fact that the water's going to come. The water's going to come regardless of what it says in the LTC. It could be that easy. I don't have any questions for you. I'm wondering if any members of the board did. Folks?
Any of those adjustments or changes retroactive? We currently have flood insurance and pay 2X. Can you then go backwards and say, well, with this new designation, I'll only in the future be paying 1X? Are you simply glad about that? Or
excellent point.
Go back and say, I'd like that. I'd like some sort of adjustment or refund or something.
So, regarding your question, it has to do with flood insurance premiums. And when maps come out or they change, it does affect your flood insurance premiums. So, take the example that today you're in a special flood hazard area and you're paying thousands of dollars for your premium. And you're required, possibly, to have that flood insurance because you have a federally backed mortgage. And your mortgage company basically says you're going to get flood insurance, you're going to keep flood insurance. And by new technical and higher resolution studies, FEMA has now determined you're no longer in a special flood hazard area. You're no longer in that high risk area. Basically, you can go back to your insurance provider, show them documentation, and your flood insurance premium will change. Should go down to the preferred risk policy, which averages around $400 a year for a typical home in Palm Coast. And let's say it goes the other way, unfortunately. So you're in a low-risk area, that X zone today. FEMA goes and says, hey, your floodplain designation has changed, now you're in a high-risk area. Let's say that happens. You have flood insurance today, and you've always carried flood insurance. You can actually benefit from a grandfather premium. If you do not have flood insurance, then you will get that high premium cost, unfortunately, become effective. If your home is built to our standard, 1 foot above BFE, which most of them are, just because we construct and review plans accurately, then you can also go to FEMA and actually ask for one of those letter map changes and show that your elevation for your finished floor is 1 foot above base flood elevation. Remember, that's at 1% annual chance of flood. You will actually get your premium reduced in that way too. And you do that through an elevation certificate. So there's numerous mechanisms to deal with when new maps come out or floodplains change. But the unfortunate part is usually when you're in that high-risk area, you're going to be dealing with high insurance premiums. If you have a federally backed loan, you're going to have to get flood insurance.
How is this information going to be communicated to the general public?
Actually, in next month's utility mailer, you're going to get a four-page insert that describes all of this in detail.
I find out what you want here.
You call me.
Call you. Okay.
Isn't there a map on the website, on the city's website?
Yes, and that is available with the new flood insurance rate map panels. But I do encourage, if someone asks you how do I figure out what floodplain I'm in, to have them call the city of Palm Coast, because sometimes it gets confusing when you look at the maps and you don't understand basically what those zones mean. And so we always encourage, and my number is on the website right there where the maps are, encouraging people to call myself or three of the other certified floodplain managers in the city.
They were actually at the home builders, or the, what was that?
The Flagler County Home Show.
The home show, and it was amazing. I went by my little girl and just the people. They had computers out there, tons of people asking that information.
I know the Flagler County appraiser puts it on his website as well.
Yes, as participation in the National Flood Insurance Program and the Community Rating System, we have to make it available to the public. The Flagler County Library is another resource where you can just walk in off the street and look at the maps. And you can do the same at City Hall. We have those readily available.
That seems to be one of the biggest questions I always get, is how do I find out? It used to be a secret almost here. You had to call an insurance guy, and he'd say, oh, yeah, you're in a floodplain. You ever get your policy?
Yeah, and one of the things that I mentioned previously, and I really appreciate the board's comments, is that we hear quite a bit that our residents that exist in Palm Coast or the residents are moving. They hear about Hurricane Irma, they hear about Hurricane Matthew, and then they are looking to buy in the city, and then they're told that they're not in a floodplain. And they're almost discouraged to get flood insurance. But as we've already discussed, if you're in one of those low-risk areas, it's quite affordable, and you have a peace of mind of coverage.
So we need a motion to recommend to the board?
Yes, sir.
Any further questions for the staff? Have a motion, gentlemen, please.
I'll move to recommend to the board approval of the orders.
Second.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Are you going to call the roll?
Yes.
This is Lucas.
Yes.
Mr. Lundberg.
Yes.
Mr. Scully.
Yes.
Mr. Davis.
Yes.
Mr. Kraft.
Yes.
Okay.
Excellent. Do we have any further business?
No. I don't have anything. You had your iPad training today, so... If y'all have any questions, I really don't know it as good as Mr. Lannan, but I got enough to get by with the eye annotate. So seriously, if y'all have any questions or some technical stuff, Irene and I will try to get the answer for you.
How about a motion to adjourn?
So moved.